The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El Khoury. Now, last week we were talking to Paul from Hearts for Learning Education about revision, and we had so many questions we had to bring him back again. So this week is part two of our interview with Paul on the topic of revision. Paul, sorry, I've got more questions for you. What if we see our child struggling or giving up? Obviously, that's everybody's worst nightmare. What should we do?
Yeah, and I think at that point, your reaction is critical to which way it goes. You're reaching a crossroads, and you have, again, it's a time to breathe, be rational, not emotional, and think very carefully, because your child is at a point of minor crisis and looks to you. And the same way as when they're a toddler and you get that thing when they fall over and there's a moment before they cry and they look at you. And if you look worried, they cry. And if you laugh, you've got a fair chance they'll just laugh. And it is exactly the same as the exam point. They meet a moment when they're stumbling, when they fall, and they look to you to go, what should my reaction be? So your response then is absolutely key, whether you end up with a scream or a laugh. So the first thing is to let the teachers know. If you think they're having a wobble, then let their teachers know. Because again, that's that other adult outside the family. You know nothing, but maybe they'll let the teacher, particularly if they've got a good relationship with the teachers or it's a subject they're struggling with. It's good just to say, look, I think they're losing a bit of confidence, because the teacher then, you will just ease up. So I might feel that I'm being really helpful with the child by giving them loads of feedback on how to improve. If I learn actually that that's not working for them, then I'll ease up on that, because I know actually I've got to switch more to boosting their confidence before I start doing that again. Making sure that the tendency is to talk about the future, and this is all about their future, but it's got to be about what they want from their future, what not what you want on their future, because quite often students feel that they're carrying the burden of the family. You know, it's certainly in certain cultures where, you know, what the neighbors think, and was this child a doctor, was this child not a doctor, that becomes a huge burden. So what do they want, not what you want, so they feel more empowered. What sometimes happens at GCSE is they've got quite a lot of subjects. They might have 8, 9, 10 subjects. They'll find one that they decide they can't do and then say to you, I want to drop that subject. Now, that is always faulty thinking, because one, schools don't have the capacity to babysit your child and safeguard your child while the others carry on with it. And secondly, because actually they don't. When I was head sit form, we used to have AS levels, and very often children would come and say, I'm doing 4 AS levels, I'll be better if I do 3. And I used to do it, and I did a statistical analysis, and it never improved their results, because they haven't got the balance right. So whatever, they've got enough time at A level to have a job, have a short job up to 10 hours a week, to do their schoolwork and have a social life. If they haven't got enough time, one of those areas is overbalanced. So if their social life is a bit wild, or they're doing too many hours, if you drop the amount of academic study, all they do is that imbalance becomes greater. So it's the same with subjects. So they'll want to give up on subjects. They've decided they chose it and they don't like it anymore because it's too difficult. So the way you have to talk that is about exams are, they're in your back pocket. They're an insurance policy. So you might want to go and be a roofer. Your child might want to be a roofer who's going to earn lots of money. That's all great. It's all great. So why do I need history? Why do I need German? Well, who knows? Who knows what's around the corner? What happens if you meet a very hot German girl and want to go and live in Germany? What happens if, you know, we know like with roofing, there's lots of injuries. If you damage your back and you can't work again, then what you do is you go back to your back pocket and you pull out this suite of results. And the suite of results tells us something about you. And if you give up on one, it tells a potential employer what happens when you find things hard. It says, I give up. So even if your child plods through their French GCSE and gets a grade 3, it shows that they stick at it. And actually, sometimes that can be the grade you can be proud. I mean, what an interesting story in an interview. Say, which grade are you proudest of? And you pick your lowest grade. How much does that tell you about a person? Now, when students get worried, then you get that fight, flight or freeze response. which is normal. So if they want a fight, they're just going to be arguing with their siblings or with you. Don't give them a fight. Just be very aware. They'll say, I want you to do this. Go in the school and tell them I want to give up history. You do that. And it's really easy to feel you're being a good parent by going in and battling the school on that. But it erodes relationships with the school, and it's not doing the right thing by the child. And most schools of their worth will say, I'm afraid we're not going to do that at this stage. The flight is more difficult to deal with that, because that can be children that just go out with their friends. They sit on their phones all the time. They actually run away from the problem. And then you need to get, they are still children, and you need to start to, I've known parents that have switched the internet off. They, you know, they've taken their phones, all those things. Actually, if their response, if it comes a bit toe to toe around that, and what they're trying to do is get out of doing any revision, you might have to do that. The freeze is the most worrying one, when they just feel so overwhelmed, they don't know where to start, so they don't start. Interestingly, quite often boys do this. Girls will cry and express their emotions. And, you know, we know that boys, it's very difficult to show emotions. The only emotion that's acceptable for a boy to show is anger, because that's manly. So quite often their upset comes out, and it's not aggression. It's not really anger, but it's frustration. So again, not responding to that, but say that's the tip of the iceberg, what's underneath it. And quite often around exam time, and boys sometimes you hit this moment of realization where they realize they haven't worked hard enough, and they get into an absolute panic. And the key thing is, okay, you might have been a lazy so-and-so for the last 3 years, but the show's not over till the fat lady sings. Anything, if the first time you revise is the night before, anything is better than nothing. So you can't allow them to sit with regret and look at what they haven't done, but really focus on the here and now. Anything is better than nothing. When they get that freeze, you've just got to have those baby steps. Let's just do a bit together. Let's just do a tiny bit. Oh, yeah. Just get them started. Build the momentum, however slow. You might be panicking at that point, but you can't let that show. There'll be a natural undulation between moments when there's a real fear and they've got an uncertainty about their future, and other moments when they feel on top of it, and it's fine. But we always go back to that unconditional love. I believe in you. And you know what? Rather than talking about success and failure, about your future here, talk about it making things easier or harder, because that's the reality. If you've got loads of great grades, it makes it easier to get great jobs. It doesn't mean you'll get them. And if you don't, it makes it harder. It doesn't make it impossible. It just makes it slower, and it makes things more difficult. So that's the way to talk about easier and harder, rather than suggesting if they don't achieve in this time, their whole future is ruined, because then that's just despairing for them and they become hopeless.
Paul, so you've given us so many valuable tips and bits and gems of information. I've got a list that I'm going to rattle off to my kids for the next few few years. Right. And I really, really thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. Right. If you think that your child is not doing enough revision, given everything you've told us about, you know, big growing elephant ears and being the cushion, not the stick, how can we do that in a careful and considered way?
So this is when it gets tricky, because teenagers are quite mercurial, and if they feel pressured, quite often they'll just dig their heels in. Again, this is a particular boy problem. When I taught GCSE business studies for a bit, and I remember in year having quite a tricky year 11 group and doing a test with them, and they got a range of results. And I said to the class, well, how many of you revised? And all the girls and only one boy, all the girls put their hand up and only one boy. And I was really miffed about it. And I said, well, you know, I had a bit of a moan. Anyway, at the end of the lesson, I gave the papers back, and I gave them back to one of the boys who hadn't put his hand up. And I said, oh, Andy, you did really well there. And he said, oh, thanks, sir. I revised really hard. And I thought, you little devil. But amongst boys, boys like to achieve, but the aim is effortless achievement. You have to look like you've put no effort in. Now, after that experience, and I'd done a lot of work around how to get boys to achieve, I used to explicitly say that to students and say, your mates, boys, will tell you, oh, I didn't revise, I just walked in and I got 80%. No, but it's fine. If you need to say that, absolutely say that. But unfortunately, every year there's one idiot who believes what his friends are saying. And then the terrible result. So you kind of, for those particularly boys where they've just got to, that whole thing about showing your machismo and showing natural brilliance that just oozes out for me, girls validate each other through hard work. And sometimes that goes the other way and they work too hard. But boys, sometimes you need to allow them that space to revise quietly and subtly and not make a big thing of it. So that's really important that if, you know, if your son's there with his mates and you say, oh, darling Colin, he's done so well and he's spent hours revising, that's going to push him to, no, I didn't, all that sort of stuff. It won't work. And we know boys take the mickey out of each other all the time. So it's very important that you allow boys to do it privately. And this is where nagging becomes a problem. The more you do, the more you force them. Well, I want you down here, I want you to do that. I've seen whole boys that were doing okay, not brilliantly, but whose parents' pressure meant they dug their heels in and they did really badly because they were losing kudos with their mates. And unfortunately, for many boys, kudos with their mates is more important than their exam results to them. So it's about focusing on gains over time, regularity, like we talked about those 20-minute slots. Even we know cognitively it's not great to do 10 minutes, but if you do that, 10 minutes after you've had your milk and cookies, 10 minutes before dinner, 10 minutes after dinner, just start to establish little as that sort of thing. Avoid them going on their phones to revise because that's just not what they should do. So I would do that. You know, allow them, like I've said, that kind of quiet compliance. Again, back to you care about their future, about their happiness. Some children, again, boys can be quite transactional. So you might pay them per grade. That can have a huge effect and it's annoying, but ultimately you can see their big picture. If it costs you £20 and set, right, every grade 6 will give you £20 over grade 7. Work out where they are and tie it to something they can buy. So if you get all grade 6s, you'll be able to buy that new PlayStation game. You'll be able to do that. That also allows boys particularly to say, oh, well, I would, but you know, I would come out tonight, but I can't because I really want that PlayStation game. So I've got to get this. It gives them a currency. Be aware that the more irate you get, the more rebellious they'll be. And keep emphasizing that idea that it's never too late. Because quite often underneath that, you've got a freeze response. However it is presented, they think, I'm overwhelmed. I can't do this. Girls sometimes will cry, but are less likely to freeze. They are more likely to work intensely, but not effectively. So they are creating reams of notes. Everything's beautifully highlighted. They've got all sorts of mind maps of words all around the room, but they're not learning any of it because that brings to their mind that actually I'm not able to recall it. And it's that never too late. Let's just get what we can do. Brilliant. Just praise. The moment you see a little bit of a break, you praise it. Even if they've done 10 minutes, you go, oh, that's great. Right, tell me what you've learned. Just write, what can you do? Oh, that's good. Have that dialogue. Make sure that anything they do is credited rather than focusing on everything they haven't done.
That's brilliant. And to be honest with you, we should know this as parents. We know ourselves that we'd rather the carrot than the stick. You know, we don't want to be nagged to do the things that we don't want to do. So that's every little, so positive reinforcement at every turn. It's never too late, which I think it's a great tip. And to just, you know, when you have that feeling of being overwhelmed, pick the smallest task, easiest task, even just to break through and get started.
And don't expect them to say, particularly boys, I'm feeling overwhelmed. This is where your elephant ears have to pick up. Talk to that kernel, work out that even if they're behaving really badly, it's that, how can I express this feeling that I've got?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And do you know, really, I think it probably the mocks are a great time to look, to reassess how your kids are getting on, but also probably to reassess how you're being as a parent. Because if you've fallen into that naggy mode where you're kind of going, what are you doing, like on the PlayStation again, get in, you know, like to kind of nudge and create the situation where you've positively got them doing what they want to do and ideally without their phones, right? I think early on building in a no phone.
Yeah, phone downstairs, revise upstairs.
Right.
And then that becomes their treat. If they want a little dopamine hit in their 10 minutes time off, they can come and do that. But if they're saying I'm revising on my phone, I would be very skeptical. And we all know that there's too many other exciting things a phone can do. And actually, some of those online platforms, they're good for revising knowledge, but they don't develop deep enough understanding. So it is part of a suite of what you do, but it shouldn't be the sole method they rely on.
Brilliant. Thanks, Paul. So we need to get things right as well as parents. So is there support out there for parents like me who's going to be in a ball next year preparing for GCSE and A-level exams?
Yes. I mean, it's trying to get the balance of things because you're there for the emotional support, and that's really important. And you are actually the key provider of that. And to actually see, I don't have to be an expert in 10 different subjects. I don't have to know A-level physics. If, you know, you happen to have an A-level in physics yourself, then that's brilliant. But actually your prime role, and even if you have got an A-level in physics, it might not be the best thing for you to be their physics tutor, because actually you are primarily the exam, you know, you're there for that support. And something I should have mentioned earlier is that quite often people project their own experiences onto their children. So if you did really well in your exams, then that's projected. And that, again, sets it. We're in a point where the children are constantly compared against others. And it's suddenly we're ranked. And quite often parent anxieties or their experiences they project onto their children was that, oh, well, I could never do maths. You must never say that, because that gives them the get out clause, as if it's a genetic thing. So keeping your idea that you... what you're already specialist in is how your child responds to things, even though we're in quite an extreme situation now. They might respond in ways that initially you think, oh, this isn't like them. But on the practical advice, obviously using school and little dialogues with the teacher, dropping little emails is really helpful. Some people go for tutors, and we might talk a bit about what you might want to look at in tutors. Just revision books. So CGP are very popular. They do revision question cards as well. If a child doesn't want to write their own, or they're just not doing it, it's a good thing to do. So those revision books are good. Again, nothing is the silver bullet. They need their own notes. They need some online stuff. They need some revision guides. The websites that they might use, the school will have platforms that can be very useful. What's great about those is they're responsive. So again, just knowing what those are is really helpful. And say, well, have you been on to My Maths? Have you been on to this? Because they've got AI in them, they will hone down on things that the students aren't doing very well. Because again, revision's difficult, and what we tend to do is comfort revision, and we tend to revise what we already know pretty well. And actually the challenge is not about getting better at things we're good at, but actually facing the things that we're not good at and making them mildly less bad. And that's hard, and psychologically and motivationally you don't want to do that, you know, but that's, you know, a really important thing. And then there's other, you know, it's if we're talking about support for parents in terms of how to help their child, then like at HFL, we run online revision classes. So that really, and those do something quite different. And each one of these things does something different. So your websites give you that knowledge recall, get the basic knowledge in. Your revision books are great when they get a bit sticky about the understanding and can explain things that might be in a different way to how the teacher explained it, but it keys into them better. And like our online revision classes, for example, focus on the real sticky bits and the exam technique. So that fourth sort of thing, what are the bits children traditionally fall down on, or where they don't, they've got the knowledge, but they don't maximize the marks because they don't write it in the same way. So it's not a reteaching bit, it's a different thing. So all these things can come to help teachers, schools and students in different ways. And it's a mosaic. It's not one way. I've bought them the revision guides and therefore they'll be fine. That's fine. That will help their understanding. It'll help some of their recall. The cards will help with their recall. Having a tutor may fill in gaps in their knowledge, help with their understanding. It won't necessarily help with their recall. So understanding back to those four different ways you go wrong. And if you can work out, particularly with that diagnostic, what bits haven't they quite got? And then which is the best way to fill the gaps that they've acknowledged.
Brilliant. Thanks, Paul. And we're rapidly running out of time, but I want to ask you quickly, tutors, what would you say about them?
Yeah, lots of people go for tutors. They can really build students' confidence. There's certain things that you need to do. It's a very big business and it's a lot of money. And unfortunately, there's some very good tutors out there and there's some absolute charlatans. So if you're going to put that much money in, then you need to ask certain questions. What specs have you taught? Because it's no good if your child's doing AQA and the teacher only knows OCR as an exam board. There are subtle differences in how you get the marks. Whilst the content is broadly similar, what they look for in the marks are key. And particularly if you're on a borderline, understanding to get a 4, I must mention this in question 2, you need that level of knowledge. See if they've marked for exam boards, because then they'll have that, again, that exam level knowledge. Ask them what grade ranges they're most comfortable teaching. So we found as a school that it actually suppressed some grades, because in English, people had English tutors and they were teaching them in those days at a C grade, exactly how to get a C grade. But we found we were better at getting children B grades if they didn't have a tutor. If they had a tutor, because they taught them a formula, which was fine getting over that boundary, but not beyond that. So you might, depending on what your student's child's looking for, that's really important. And just asking them some questions, you know, in your experience, what aspects of the exam do children struggle at? That will tell you whether they know it or not. Now, you can use friends, university students, A-level students. That will fix the understanding. But what it won't do is give them that exam technique, which we find like through our revision classes. That's a real key thing. You can know it. We can know all the information. But if I don't hit the exact points that the examiner is looking for, that's really important. And then an absolutely critical thing is that they don't rely on their tutor and ease up at school. So often children will say, they'll basically put their feet up in school, say, oh, it's all right, I'll do it with my tutor. You've got an hour a week of your tutor. You might have 5 hours of maths in school. So it's really important that they don't. And quite often children do that. The other thing is to make sure that you select the right thing, because quite often tutors, they do exactly what we were talking about before. And they work with the thing that the student's most comfortable at. It's really nice. The tutor sees them making progress, sees them being happy. The child enjoys it. They all feel successful. And the things that they can't do left undone. And that doesn't fill their gaps.
Yeah, you've hit so many very valuable points there, Paul. And I think, yeah, it is so, so helpful to parents. Now, we're coming to the end of our interview. That has been just spectacularly helpful. I'm sure parents are scribbling notes like I am throughout that. What, last question, what if they don't get what they need? You've said it's not the end of the world, and I can totally, totally relate to that. What would you say to parents? What if the worst happens?
Well, if the worst happens, so I think it's not the worst, is it? It's just a little stumble along the way. So the language that you use about it, okay, it's disappointing, it's not a catastrophe. Exams can always be retake. You know, you can just start again if you need to. There's nothing at 16 or 18 you can't recover in time. It's back to, it'll take a bit of time. It's a little bit harder, but it's not the end of the world. That's really, really important. And like anything, they need a bit of time to grieve. They need, it's no good you saying it doesn't matter, because it does matter. And what matters a lot, and the reason it matters, is that it's suddenly their future has just suddenly swerved. And compared to their peers, you've got this whole thing. They feel like they can lose their confidence and feel silly in front of their friends, which we know for teenagers is really important. Now, part of it is when you get the predictions from the school, actually taking those really seriously, looking at the mocks and the predictions, and teachers tend to be a little bit optimistic, particularly at A level. So it's good to have an honest conversation with teachers, particularly when A level and deciding on university, for example, say, how secure are these? Are these hopeful or are they secure? So you can start to work out if this is likely to be a possibility. You know, anyone can walk into an exam and have a bad day, but a teacher may well say, well, I've put a, you know, C grade. I think there's a fair chance I'll get a D. If that grade is critical to them getting into university, you can slightly preempt it straight away. So with university and A levels, you go through clearing. Again, if you pre-consider it, if you know that it's a bit dodgy, you can have had those conversations with your child. You might have visited certain universities. You might look at the next level down. Well, if you don't get that, so you're ready. So on that day, you go, right, plan B goes into place. We get on the phone. They got on the phone. They need a bullet point of why they've chosen that university, even if they've just chosen it that morning, not just I need somewhere. And a series of bullet points about what they've got to offer and what their experience is. That must be done by the student, not by the parent. As much as you want to take control, that will undermine and make it less likely to get it. You can do remarks or retakes, but it's very important. Quite often, this isn't isn't the answer. People think the immediate thing is there must be a problem. Retaking your exams, yeah, you can spend another year. The key is that you get government fund you from 16 to 19. So you've got an extra year at sixth form if you need it. So some people will take that when they've not got their level two qualification, which is your five GCSEs at four and above. So they do a course at college and they're a year behind their friends, but then they've still got 2 years to do a level three course, be that BTEC, A-levels and apprenticeship. So it's important to realise that funding lasts for 3 years. So there is some give in the system. Remarks are, they've changed how they remark it. So it used to be, you know, you could be one mark off the next grade and you could, they'd send it in for a remark. And if that person gave you one more mark, you'd get the grade up. That has changed now. They look at it and they go, was this marking reasonable? So unless it's quite wildly out, so 75% of remarks stay where they are. So if you think your child, those speculative remarks are very expensive and cost up to £200 a subject, and 75% of the time that's thrown away. So talk to the school. The school can get the exam paper back. They can look and then can tell you realistically. They mark them in bands. So if the band is broadly average, as long as they've got the right band, then one or two marks either way won't make a difference. So I wouldn't rely on that. And the other thing is sometimes at exam time, something goes wrong in the exam and people ask for special considerations, and they seem to feel if they get school, they put the school under a lot of pressure and it's virtually worthless. If you have a major trauma, like you lose a parent the week before the exam, they'll give you 5%. That's it. So, you know, they're being drilling outside the classroom. It's not worth your effort. And actually, it takes the child and parents away from the focus. Right, dump that. That probably didn't make a difference. Move on. But the key is that, you know, colleges will have people available on that day. Schools will be talking about things. So there's all sorts of support wrapped around. The key thing is be sensible about it and don't pressure. If your child hasn't got, and when I was ahead of sixth form, I'd have children that came and they hadn't quite got their GCSEs that needed to do A-level. And I used to be what I thought was kind and put them on A-level. And I stopped doing that because they weren't ready. And it wasn't a kindness. So you might feel you've been a super parent. You've gone in and they haven't got their GCSE in English and you've got them to do A-level courses. The reality is they're not ready and they're going to fail and they're going to waste 2 years. And then if they waste 2 years and fail their A-levels, they've only got what they can't retake their A-levels to such a degree. So actually taking a deep breath and going, maybe this is about time, we just need to slow up, is really important, rather than powering through for the sake of keeping up with the Joneses and feeling like an amazing parent and just kicking that can down the road for a bigger, more important, more devastating failure in the future.
That makes complete sense. And I think as parents, we're always guilty of just wanting to keep things, appearances right, particularly around exams, because everybody knows somebody who got straight nines and, you know, and you know, everybody wants to be that parent, but the reality is very few of us are, you know. But that's super helpful, Paul. I mean, there's so much to learn from what you've said. And for me, it comes back to, you know, what you said at the very beginning about when you get those mocks and identifying what's gone wrong. Like, did you know, in exams, did you not know? Did you forget? Did you not understand an exam technique? And if you solve those four issues within each subject, you're on the path to success. Yeah. And it does mean hard work. And yes, it's boring, but that's just the reality of it. This part of your life is meant to be hard work, isn't it? But also a lot of fun.
Yes. And, you know, they've got that lovely long holiday, probably the longest summer holiday in your life. And I always remember talking to a child who'd not done very well at GCSE, and he came back afterwards. And I said, but I told you, Dave, I said you weren't revising hard enough. Why didn't it get through? What could I say to a student to stop them doing it in the future? And he said to me, the thing is, sir, what you should say is, you look, that holiday is iconic. You look forward to it. You plan what you're going to do with your students. You feel, you know, you burn your school jumper, you throw your books away. And I was looking forward to it so much, but I didn't put the work in. And that holiday became terrible because I just sat with regret. And all my hopes and dreams, I was going away with my friends. I was doing all these, they do quite a lot of these sort of threshold activities. And he said they were all spoiled because I knew I hadn't done my best. Tell them that.
Yeah.
About having the great holiday, but it's the reward for working hard.
Brilliant. Great stuff. I hope it works. I'm going to try anyway, Paul. But listen, it's been fantastic talking to you. And thanks so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a little break on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes. So stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again. I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Jess Smith from Raiden Solicitors here in St Albans. And of course, Raiden Solicitors are the sponsors of The Parents Show. So Jess, before we go into talking about no-fault divorce, which is our topic for today, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Hello. So I'm Jess. I am a family law solicitor at Raiden Solicitors. So I deal with relationship breakdown, and that involves divorce, dealing with child arrangements, and also finances. Generally, that's the bulk of my work. I've been at Raiden's for 6 years now. So one of the long ones. That's me.
Fantastic. Thanks a million, Jess. Now, today, the plan is to talk about no-fault divorce. Can you tell us, for our listeners who don't know, what is no-fault divorce?
I can indeed. So there was a big reform to the divorce law, which was implemented. It was the 6th of April 2022. So it's actually not that new. It's now nearly 4 years old, although it feels new still, and everyone still calls it the new change. But essentially what happened is people who want to divorce now don't need to give a reason for that divorce. So they can apply to the court to end their marriage without having to give a reason why their marriage has broken down. So that's the big change.
Thanks a million. So what was wrong with the old divorce system, Jess? Why did it need changing?
So the big problem was that people had to attribute blame for a divorce. So essentially, there was a lot of people where there was a mutual decision to get divorced, but then in a divorce application, they were having to come up with a reason. So sometimes just make up or create a reason, which doesn't start things off on a very good track. So a lot of the time, people are going to be dealing with arrangements for their children and dividing their finances. And actually, to be putting blame on someone at the beginning of that process, it doesn't start the tone very well. And it just creates an unnecessary conflict between people. And actually, the big thing that probably I should say behind it all is that the court aren't generally interested about why people are divorcing. That they're sort of trying to look forward in and help people go their separate ways. So actually, the reasons for a divorce in most cases aren't that relevant. And so for people to have to write down on an application what's gone wrong doesn't really have any bearing on anything going forward. And so actually, the whole concept was changed just so that people could start off a process without having to blame somebody and without having to come up with a reason why their marriage had broken down. That's essentially what happened.
It makes complete sense, because obviously if the first thing you're going to do is start blaming each other, it's not going to go constructively or positively. Brilliant. So that the blame element is gone now. So can you tell us, how does a no-fault divorce process work today?
Yes. So essentially it's all done online, the actual divorce process, and couples can either apply on their own or they can apply jointly if they want to. If they want to be collaborative, they can do it together. And essentially one of them goes on, makes the application, the other one responds to that application. And in that response, if, for example, we're in a situation where one person wants the divorce and another doesn't, the person that doesn't actually have the opportunity to contest the divorce as such. There's only very, very limited grounds that they can do that. For example, if there's a lack of jurisdiction in this country. And so actually the divorce can proceed whether the respondent, as they're called, likes it or not. So it actually makes the whole process much more streamlined and easy. But that, yeah, it's essentially an application, a response, and then two orders that are made, and then the divorce is done.
And that's great that there's no blockage in the sense that one person can't stop the divorce going ahead.
Exactly.
If they want to do, because I know in divorce in other parts of the world, that is possible. And it means that you're in limbo for the rest of your life if you can't fix it.
Yeah, and it means that one person can be is being forced to stay in a relationship that they don't want to be in. And that's obviously against human rights and all sorts. So yeah, it's good that now the process can just sort of proceed regardless. If one person, if that's their choice, then that's their choice.
Brilliant. Thanks a million, Jess. So that means, I mean, I'm kind of doubling back now. So one person can initiate the process completely on their own.
They can, yeah.
Great. And is there a cooling off period or a waiting period before the kind of wheels start turning in the process?
Yeah, so that's one thing that hasn't really changed in terms of the divorce process. So one party or jointly, people will make the application, and then the court has imposed a 20-week waiting period after the application has been processed. And the aim of that cooling off period is for people to reflect, make sure it's what they want, and also it gives an opportunity for them to deal with those other aspects of child arrangements, finances, because they take often a little bit longer to deal with. And then after that 20 weeks, they're able to apply for the first order within the divorce process.
It kind of makes sense that there's time to reflect, because we are talking about emotions and people can get very whipped up about these things, obviously, understandably. But to have a time to just reflect is probably good. And that's a good amount of time. It's not 20 weeks. I mean, it's a long enough period, but it's not too long.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's a big decision to go through a divorce. And so you want to make sure you're doing the right thing. And like you said, emotions are involved, and people will sometimes do things based on emotion. And actually, they then have reconciliation conversations and realise it's not what they want. And it's quite easy to withdraw the application at that stage rather than when it gets to the next stage when the court's making orders. So that's why the cooling off period is there. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, brilliant. And so now, roughly, how long does the whole process take?
So from application to getting the final divorce order, which is the order that formally ends your marriage, it's a minimum of 26 weeks, so about 6 months. The reality is that it's probably going to be a longer period of time than that, because the court has a processing time between each stage. And also, this is just the divorce process itself. It's not dealing with any of the associated financial elements. And we generally tell clients not to apply for that final order until they have all their finances resolved. So sometimes it will take longer because finances can be quite complicated. So actually, in reality, it's longer than 26 weeks. But if everything is smooth sailing and people come to agreements quite quickly, then it's a 26 weeks minimum.
26 week minimum. Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you. So the next question is, has this changed how people are reacting to divorce? Has it de-escalated tensions? Has it made things smoother? Is it making life better for those involved?
So within the divorce process itself, I would say yes, because there is nowhere for there to be a dispute anymore. You're literally ticking a box on an application which says our marriage has broken down irretrievably, and that's the end of that. So in terms of the divorce process, I'd say yes, it's made a big difference, and people aren't having arguments about what should be included in a divorce application. But what I would say is, as a family law solicitor, people generally only come to me when they are having issues, where they are having problems communicating with their spouse, where they are unable to reach agreements with their spouse about the other aspects, so the finances, child arrangements. And so those tensions do still exist, even if they're not put on a divorce application. And what I would say, some people are keen to attribute that blame, whether it's in the application or elsewhere. So I often have to talk to clients about where the relevant place is to bring up anything that's happened during the marriage, because sometimes it is relevant in dealing with the finances or children matters, but other times it's not. And if the court's not going to be interested, then essentially people are wasting their time in raising these things in a legal arena, and they're wasting their money on legal fees in doing so. So what I would say is that the divorce application itself, definitely better, less tensions, less conflict. But if people are hell-bent on wanting to attribute that blame, which again, there's a lot of emotions, people are upset, they will find somewhere else to sort of push that blame out within the divorce process overall, if that makes sense.
Completely. Thanks, Jess. So, because obviously, just because the process has changed and the kind of starting pistol isn't blame, it doesn't mean you're going to remove all the barriers and all the kind of areas of tension. So what you're saying makes complete sense. Now, getting more into the nitty gritty, does the no-fault divorce change how assets are actually divided?
No. So the divorce law is literally in relation to the divorce process itself. It doesn't have any bearing on the finances at all or children matters. So they are still dealt with it very separately by the courts, by us. And like I say, that's generally where conflicts will arise, is in those areas, because they're the areas that matter to people. But the divorce process itself is the only part of that law that's changed.
Okie doke. So no effect on assets, child arrangements or maintenance. They stay the same.
No.
Great. Lovely and clear. Thank you. What would you say is the biggest myth people have about a no-fault divorce?
Funnily enough, I think it's that they still have the option to blame.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I have people sometimes ask if they can still respond to an application and say what's happened during the marriage and attribute that blame. And we have the process is very much out of our hands. It is simply one person applies, the marriage is broken down, and that's the end of that. So it always shocks me that obviously it's called no fault divorce. That's not the legal name, but that's what it's known as. But people still want to do that, and they still think they can dispute a divorce. That always surprises me too. But I mean, it's a quick conversation and explaining that it's not possible anymore.
And it's conversations like this that'll raise awareness around it. But I think probably television has a role to play in this. We probably have just seen so many dramas where, you know, it's like the starting pistol is fault, blame.
Well, because that's where all the drama is, isn't it? That makes for good telly and radio and whatever. But yeah.
They'll have to catch up now as well. Right. So at what point is it best to get legal advice, Jess? What's your recommendation?
I mean, I would say once you've sort of made that decision that you want to end your marriage, I think it's good to have even that initial advice before maybe you've even spoken to your spouse, just to understand your legal position, because a lot of people, when they come to see us, they're quite misled about what the position is going to be in terms of what's going to happen to their children, how often they're going to see their children, but also in relation to their finances. The divorce process itself, it isn't very shocking. There's not really much happening there. But in terms of the finances and children, just to understand what the divorce actually means for you going forward and how it's going to change your life in every aspect. So I would say as soon as you can. But again, in some situations, it's not required. If you're on amicable terms and you can have good discussions between you, then that's great. And you can do it all without lawyers if that's the case. I would say if you are struggling to communicate with your spouse, if you are having discussions but can't reach any agreements, obviously, if you're affected by domestic abuse, then I think that's where legal advice is crucial, because that's where lawyers can unlock all of that for you and support you in the process. Yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. And actually, as you say, you know, early on might be good. And indeed, you might just find that the legal advice you get at the start sets you up and provides you with the information, you know, to maybe go down a more amicable route, because at least you're equipped with the facts.
Exactly. And your expectations are set a bit better. And sometimes it's all that you need is that initial meeting. And actually that sets you up for all of the discussions, and you might not require any more legal advice. But just knowing what your legal position is, I think, is really important.
Why would you guess it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, exactly.
Why would you leave it to chance? Or why would you, which is probably even scarier, ask an LLM or ChatGPT to help you with something like this?
It's a bit like when you've got something wrong with your health, you don't diagnose yourself, do you? You go to a doctor.
Yeah.
So if the option is there and you are in a position where you think that you'd benefit from that understanding, I think it's great.
Brilliant. Thanks a million, Jess. So it's brilliant that no fault divorce has come in, well received, well thought through. Are there other areas of family law that need a little bit of tweaking, bit of reform?
Definitely.
Okay.
I would say the big one is financial rights for cohabitees. So despite, I don't know why this myth exists, there's a whole concept of common law marriage, which people think applies to when you live with somebody, that you're protected. That is no legal concept. It doesn't exist. So essentially, where we're in an environment now where people are choosing to live together more and more, much more than they used to, maybe before they get married, but maybe they just never want to get married. I think that they are a lot of the time under illusions that they're protected financially. But the reality is that they're not in the same way that married couples are. And if they were to split, the way that, especially finances, the way that assets are and income are divided is in relation to ownership. So if you own a property together, that's going to dictate who walks away with what. There's no adjustments that can be made when you're unmarried. And this is, I think, an area where family lawyers are calling out for a reform, because there are so many cohabiting couples now and people that have been cohabiting for a very long period of time, and they're making financial commitments, but that they will never see back. And don't get me wrong, that there are ways that you can challenge the legal ownership to divide them, not based on what they are like legally on paper. But those processes are very, very complicated and very, very expensive and just out of reach for most people. So, yeah, I think that's the big area that a lot of people are calling for reform on, I would say.
I wasn't aware of it until, like, I've had the opportunity to speak to you and other colleagues, and I was really surprised by it as well. I just assumed when you hit a certain number of years together, surely something kicks in to give you equal rights, and it's not.
Nothing.
And I heard one of your colleagues, actually, I had a chat with recently, they said a great phrase that stuck in my head. It's like, you don't get the benefits of the club if you're not in the club, i.e. marriage, you know. Yep. So if you're not in it, you don't get the benefits, which I think helps people understand, you know, that cohabitation doesn't give you the same rights as marriage.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. If somebody's thinking about getting a divorce, what do you think they should do first, Jess?
So I would say talk to your loved ones, talk to people that will give you sensible, rational advice. Most people have people around them that they can confide in, and just to sort of get your feelings out there. I mean, if it's not someone that you want to talk to close to you, but maybe a therapist or a counsellor or someone, I have a lot of clients that have found that very helpful. But again, I go back to legal advice, even if it's just an initial meeting, just go and understand where you stand legally and what a divorce is going to mean for you practically and the impact on your life it's going to have. I can't stress enough how much people appreciate that. Even after an hour of advice, everyone's finding out things that they didn't know. So that's what I would say, probably the first few things: talk to people and get some advice.
Because it's going to be out in the open anyway. If you are going to get a divorce, you're going to have to go public with it. So you best off test, you know, with
exactly.
People you trust and who are close to you, I guess.
Yeah.
And now we're rapidly running out of time, Jess. So I have one last question for you before we go, which is, what's the one thing you wish the public understood about divorce law today?
I think the big one, which I take for granted because it's my job, is that there are three different tracks when it comes to separating. So there's the divorce process, which we've spoken a lot about today. That's quite an easy process, all done online, one very separate thing. Then there's the finances. So when you're divorcing, you obviously have to work out how your assets and your income is going to be split. And then there's the children and working out who they're going to live with, who they're going to spend time with, their schooling, all of the things that children need. So the big thing for me is that they are three separate things, because generally clients come to me and they think that it's all wrapped up in one and they can deal with it all together. But the reality is that the best way to look at it is three separate things. Divorce process is the easy bit. Finances is one part, and children is one part. And to sort of separate them all out and think about them all individually, that's the big thing, I think, that people don't sort of grasp.
No,
when they're first separating.
That's really, really helpful. Mm. And to kind of conceptualize it in those three different tracks helps manage expectations too.
Exactly that.
Brilliant. Jess, it's been fantastic to speak to you. Thanks so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that was Jess Smith from Raiden Solicitors, and Raiden Solicitors are indeed sponsors of The Parents Show.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.